Today, the United States and Turkey have agreed to a ceasefire in Syria. The Turkish side will pause Operation Peace Spring in order to allow for the withdrawal of YPG forces from the safe zone for 120 hours. All military operations under Operation Peace Spring will be paused, and Operation Peace Spring will be halted entirely on completion of the withdrawal.
Vice President Mike Pence today in Ankara announcing Turkey would halt its invasion of northern Syria to allow a Kurdish-led militia to withdraw from the region. Meanwhile, there are big questions about what the Pentagon's plan in Syria will be moving forward. Missy Ryan joins us now to fill us in on the new developments. She covers the Pentagon, military issues, and the national security for The Washington Post. And welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I hope you're well. So what do we know about this deal that Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have announced in Turkey?
Well, this was announced in Turkey after Vice President Pence sat down with the Turkish leader, and there has been a pretty bare-bones document, a joint statement that has been circulated. And Vice President Pence has described what he says is, as we heard in the clip, a ceasefire between the Turkish forces, Turkish-backed forces, and the Syrian Kurdish forces who have been an ally of the United States in this area of northern Syria that has really been the site of a lot of chaos and fighting over the last 10 days. But there are many, many unanswered questions right now in terms of how such a ceasefire will be monitored, who will be the guarantor of this kind of agreement, whether or not the Syrian Kurds themselves, who are the second direct party in such an arrangement, have agreed to it, and also what will be the impact on American plans to draw all but a very small contingent of U.S. forces out of Syria within weeks. So these are the things that we're trying to determine right now. It's a fast-moving situation, but it is a significant development.
And the ceasefire, it's only to last 5 days, 120 hours. Is there any indication of what would happen next?
Well, the goal, as described by Vice President Pence, is that this is an interim step in which the Syrian Kurdish forces who have been in the area directly south of the Turkish border could withdraw, and that Turkey would stop its attacks on those forces. And basically, it would be a return to a proposed buffer zone along the Syrian-Turkish border that President Erdogan has been pushing for a long time. And so what Pence described was, you know, for this five-day period, there would be a ceasefire, the Kurds would draw back, and then the idea is that there will be further negotiations, hopefully sort of making this permanent, and then the United States would agree to roll back sanctions that it has introduced on Turkey to sort of punish them for conducting this offensive.
Okay, and as you said, so many questions, and we don't have the information yet. So I'm going to shift gears now and look at the bigger picture of the Pentagon's strategy in Syria after the U.S. announced it was withdrawing troops from northern Syria. And first, let's listen to what Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer had to say about ISIS yesterday after he came out of that contentious meeting with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and President Trump at the White House.
I said, is there any intelligence evidence that the Turks and the Syrians will have the same interest that the Kurds or we did in guarding ISIS? And the Secretary of Defense was, thank God, he was honest. He said, we don't have that evidence. And so I said, then how can we think that this is a plan when there are Syrians and Turks who are not our friends, who ISIS, if they escape, does them very little harm? How can we let this happen? They didn't have any good answer. This is appalling. The president had no plan, no real plan for containing ISIS other than relying on the Syrians and the Turks.
Is Senator Schumer right? Does the president or the Pentagon really have no plan?
Well, the plan had been for American forces to remain. Again, it's still a pretty small force. It was about 1,000 troops in Syria for the foreseeable future to work with the Syrian Kurdish force to make sure that ISIS, which, you know, has been defeated in terms of its large ground presence, to make sure it doesn't come back. You know, this is an organization that has reinvented itself several times now over a decade. And so that was the plan. And President Trump and the Turkish operation really upended that and precipitated this withdrawal. And so, no, I mean, the Pentagon leadership is in the process of trying to revise its plan at this point. And so what they hope to do or had hoped to do prior to the ceasefire announcement was figure out how they can, if at all, continue to fight the Islamic State in Syria from outside Syria.
Right.
And, you know, they said that they wanted to continue to partner with the Syrian Kurdish force in any way that they could, but it wasn't clear, frankly, whether the Kurds would even want to do that because their complaint was that they had just been betrayed by America.
Right. And walk us through some of those challenges. Specifically, what the Pentagon faces trying to conduct a campaign against ISIS remotely from outside of Syria.
Well, it's a good question. And what had made the campaign so successful from a military perspective since 2015 was that, you know, the United States had a strong partner force in the Syrian Kurds in Syria. And so a small number of U.S. advisors were able to come in and work with them, help them plan and conduct operations against these enclaves, militant enclaves, and then the United States and some of its coalition partners provided close air support. They provided airstrikes against the militants, and now they're going to have to, you know, the Kurds would also help provide intelligence and would kind of give them a better picture of what was going on the ground. And so now they're going to have to do that, at a great disadvantage. It's not clear that the Kurds would continue to work as a ground force for the United States. They'll have a really hard time getting the same level of intelligence potentially that they had over the last 4 years. And then there's the question of, would the United States be able to conduct air operations inside of Syria now that the Syrian government, the government of Bashar al-Assad, who is partnered with Russia, seem to be moving back in areas that they had been shut out of for a long time and taking control, presumably, of the airspace? So that would potentially pose a real impediment to the U.S. even doing these standoff air operations against militants.
And even if they could do that, has air power been effective in fighting ISIS in the first place and these types of militants and insurgents?
It has been effective in depriving the militants of, you know, the ability to have, you know, a training camp that is visible from the air or, you know, a big weapons factory, you know, when that can be detected. So it's an important component, but the counterterrorism experts will tell you that alone it makes it much harder to keep any militant group defeated if it's just based on air power. There really needs to be a ground component as well.
And turning to the big looming international security question, this pullout of U.S. troops and the alliance between Kurds and the Syrian government, that can only strengthen Bashar al-Assad's position. So what does a stronger Assad mean for the U.S. role in the Middle East?
Well, President Trump's critics have said that it undermines American influence and that it actually could lead to a more destabilized Middle East because Assad from the beginning was not directing his energy at battling the Islamic State. In fact, many of the people who became the sort of key militants in the early version of the Islamic State had been released from Syrian prisons. And Turkey, if we're talking about a strengthened Turkish role as well, Turkey did not do a lot in the early years to stop militants pouring or would-be people who wanted to join ISIS pouring south across their border into Syria. So, you know, the critics of President Trump have said that this is something that actually will further destabilize the region. And, you know, it's just something that we're going to have to keep tracking.
Missy Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Missy Ryan writes about the Pentagon, military issues, and national security for The Washington Post. Coming up, the White House now admits aid to Ukraine was held up because the president wanted help from foreign governments to investigate unfounded allegations about Democrats and the 2016 elections. It happens all the time, they say. Our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, talks quid pro quo. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave and for Madeline Brand. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney dropped some big news bombs in a rare press briefing today. First, he announced that President Trump awarded next year's Global 7 Summit of World Leaders to his own resort near Miami.
How can the White House really make the argument that this was the only place that the G7 summit could be?
It's not the only place. It's the best place. Those are two different things, okay? But we had
there
dates.
There are other good places without the
president. There's plenty of other good places in this country to hold a large event. There's no question about it.
And later during the briefing, Mulvaney also confirmed that the White House did hold up military aid for Ukraine, in part because the president wanted the country to investigate the 2016 election.
Did he also mention to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money.
That statement would seem to undercut what Trump has been saying since the release of the transcript of his call with the Ukrainian president, that there was absolutely no quid pro quo when it came to that military aid for Ukraine. Our legal guru, Jessica Levinson, is here to weigh in on today's bombshells. She's a constitutional law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal eagle, although I have nominated you for legal guru now. Hi, Jessica.
It's promotion day here at KCRW.
You're welcome. Okay, well, I don't know where to start, but let's start with that admission about the Ukrainian military aid. And I do want to play a little bit more of the back and forth from that press conference.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that he ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate.
Withholding the funding.
Yeah, which ultimately then flowed.
Okay, how should we think about that? Was the acting chief of staff basically acknowledging after the fact the elephant in the room these past few days and you know, saying the quiet part out loud about aid being withheld from a foreign country for political reasons?
So yes and no. It's really, I just came from class and it was while this news was breaking and we were talking about congressional oversight and impeachment. And we were talking about whether or not the House was going to have to decide to impeach based on essentially obstruction of the impeachment proceedings. But now we have some bombshells. So things have changed. Now, what has Mulvaney admitted to? One reading of this is, good Lord, this is quid pro quo. This is withholding military aid for partisan, political, personal purposes. And that is not acceptable.
You just use the word acceptable.
That is not acceptable. It is misuse of office. It is illegal. It is impeachable.
Thank you. Let me be clear.
Yes. My students also ask me for those follow-ups sometime. On the other hand, what we could say is presidents engage in this type of political pressure all the time. If you think that there's something corrupt, if you think that there's something untoward, if you think that it's the Ukraine who's in the best position to look into this, then you say, I want you to look into this. And how do you force them to do that? You say, if you want your military aid, you'll do this because it's for the good of all of us. It's good policy. And
is that extortion?
So, no, that is how presidents exert political pressure on allies all the time. There's a difference between
extortion. Okay, they do it all the time, but this is different. That's what you're saying.
I think this reads much more intuitively and much more logically as President Trump saying, I want this information because it's helpful for me personally and it's helpful for me politically. Not it's helpful for the United States government or it's good for the American people. And those are very different things.
Wait, does it matter, though, that the White House eventually released this money without, it would seem, the Ukrainians agreeing to do the investigation?
No. I mean, so it matters to the extent that it you know, we didn't follow through on this potential threat of extortion for a long time, but an attempt at misuse of office, an attempt at extortion alone is enough.
So attempt and intent, those two together.
Yes.
Okay. So Mulvaney also claims that withholding aid wasn't about investigating the Bidens, right? We're talking now about the DNC server and Democrats in the 2016 election. So does it even matter the reason?
So it does matter because, again, if what you're looking at is corruption in general, because we want a world free of corruption and it has nothing to do with political gain, then that is what presidents should do. They should be trying to implement policy that's good for people. If it is, just because it's an election that's passed doesn't mean that it's not personally helpful to the president and helpful for his reelection campaign.
Okay. We also have two other big things to get
yes.
to. Mulvaney also defended Giuliani running point on key Ukraine issues. And he said that Trump is president. He can give assignments to anyone he wants. And the administration has been saying this, tossing that line out all along. But does this formal acknowledgement of Giuliani's role have legal implications?
It does. This is a weird one. There's a very old federal statute called the Logan Act. And what it essentially says is that a private citizen can't conduct foreign business in the sense of the business of the American people. You can't decide as the president that, oh, I just met this lovely person in a cafe and I would like for them to try and broker Mideast peace. That when it comes to our allies, when it comes to our adversaries, they have to know they're dealing with the American government. And so the president can't simply kind of wave a wand. Now, certainly people back channel, people ask private citizens to engage in foreign policy, but this is different. Just because you acknowledge it doesn't mean it's okay.
Okay, and now to another really big issue, and that's that the president awarded the G7 summit of world leaders to himself. And the 2020 summit will be held at Trump, it's called Trump Doral, a golf resort outside Miami. What's the problem here?
So the problem here is using your office for personal gain. That's on the broadest possible level. What we want is the whole reason that presidents have to put their assets in a blind trust, divest of assets, is that we don't want to be thinking, did the president make that decision because it's good for his pocketbook or because it's good for his constituents? And that's what this fundamentally boils down to. So we're looking at, frankly,
but we've been talking about the emoluments clause all along.
Exactly. So
is this a level higher or what?
It does feel like it's much more direct in the sense that what President Trump is doing is he's using his public office and he's using it to facilitate a massive contract that would benefit him personally, directly, and financially. And that feels different from the other emoluments clause cases where, for instance, you had to prove that foreign officials were staying at the Trump Hotel instead of somewhere else, and you had to kind of prove this causation. This feels more direct. But even without the emoluments clause, a term that we never used 3 years ago, you still have the potential of abuse of office for personal financial gain. That alone is an ethical and legal problem.
Jessica Levinson, thank you so much for being a voice of sanity on our program today.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School. Well, coming up, artist Shireen Nashat didn't exhibit any work until she was in her early 30s.
Art is something that you gain through experience of living a life. It's something that you throw yourself into the world and you get beaten up and you see good and bad. And then you find questions, not answers.
Nashat has her first big West Coast exhibit opening Saturday at the Broad. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Shireen Nashat has made art around the world for the last 30 years. Her work uses different media to explore complicated political realities, focusing particularly on Iran and America. She creates videos, writes poetry, and takes photographs, all aimed at examining the borders and intersections of nation, gender, exile, and spirit. Nashat has never opened an exhibition of her work in the Western United States until now. The Broad is hosting Nashat's largest survey of work and first major West Coast exhibition. It's called I Will Greet the Sun Again. And Shireen Nashat joins me now. It is so nice to have you here in our studio.
Thank you for having me.
And so that everyone can visualize at least one piece of your work, if they haven't seen it while we're talking, I'd like to start with a photo from your Women of Allah series. And it's the photo of a woman holding her fingers up to her mouth. And on the back of her hand, you've superimposed or overlaid calligraphy. And could you describe it for us? Because you could do it better than I can. And tell us what the writing says.
Well, for some of our friends who know my work is really focusing always on the female body. This series that you're talking about focuses on women who are militant. It's called Women of Allah, women that voluntarily participated during the revolution in the military. And so for me, this issue was full of contradictions in a way that women who give birth and are so sensual and so full of life that are able to also kill and commit violence, etc. So this one image you're speaking about, it is with the hand of a woman in front of her lip. For me, at once, it expresses this woman's submission to faith, to religion, to the ideology that she's, you know, raised with. At the same time, a feeling of oppression and betrayal and sort of being brainwashed. Of course, all of these images refer to the post-revolutionary Iran. So these are work that I made in reaction to the revolution and not relevant to today. So it's really about women that cannot speak but want to speak and are somehow brainwashed by certain ideology that they're no longer in control of.
It's interesting in that one photo, it brings together so many impressions. Hands, they are, you pray with your hands.
Yes.
And also her fingers on her mouth, as you say, almost as if I will not speak, but I want to.
Yes. And the reason that I use the words that are written as calligraphy directly on the photographs are by Iranian women poets. For me, that was another layer of contradiction, that on the surface you see these very submissive images of women that seem that have been repressed, but the words express their emotional, intellectual capability and give you another opening into their minds and their lives. A lot of the writing are quite rebellious and very confrontational. So I sort of like this interplay of submission and yet protest.
It's also so interesting aesthetically, because when you first see that photograph, you think, oh, it's like henna on her hands. And then you realize, wait, no, that's not on the hands. That's been overlaid in an artistic process. So it's like this ancient practice that's combined with a great deal of craft. And it seems to be that you do create these tensions in the work. What were you getting at with the overlay?
Well, at the beginning, you know, I was doing everything very intuitively. But when I look back retrospectively, I see that how much my work is deeply inspired by both classical Persian and Islamic art, in the way that the text is always integrated, you know, in decorative objects to our books, to carpets, to architecture. And this is the environment that I grew up with. And somehow the integration of text and photography to me seems like also a reminiscence of this contradiction between the Islamic and the Persian identity. And, you know, the images are very Islamic, but then the words are very Persian. And so I think it further complicates the images, as opposed to being simply a representation of women that are oppressed, etc. Actually, I think everything sort of is meant to build layers of intentions and meanings.
Hmm. Now, the exhibition looks at your whole 30-year career and combines, as we said, earlier work like Women of Allah with these newer pieces. And one of these newer pieces is a project called Land of Dreams. Tell us about this. It involves both photographs and videos.
So it's really a political satire in many ways. It's a surrealistic narrative about an Iranian woman immigrant that sort of goes around door to door to American people's home. She's a photographer like I am, and asking to take people's photographs, portraits. But quickly after, she asks if she could also collect their latest dream. And so some people share their latest dream. And then she drives back on the same road that she came, and she goes to this very strange colony that is full of Iranian people, and they're secretly analyzing American people's dreams.
Oh, it's like a Black Mirror exhibition abroad.
So this actress, the photographer, is she a stand-in for you as the artist satirically? Because that would make you a spy.
Yes, in many ways, she embodies who I am. For example, this whole business about myself being in many ways in trouble with my own country as I'm an artist in exile, and the anxiety and the fear I have of this dictatorship, and yet the anxiety and fear that I have of this government and this country in the way that I feel also cornered as an immigrant. So I wanted to make a film that, while it's sort of making these political critiques from one community to the other, is an individual experience being cornered on both sides and not quite feeling safe. And the one thing that she really does feel comfortable is when people share, American people share their dreams, she begins to see how their dreams and their nightmares is not that different that of her own. And I think that's the whole central focus on this film, that we all dream and have similar nightmares in this world.
And that's where we meet in our
and
humanity.
And that's exactly our humanity. And so this individual is able to transcend the political environment and see within herself that there is no difference between the Iranians and Americans. We are all under political injustice and repression in different degrees. But what we do have is our humanity and our suffering and our pain and our struggles. It just varies in different degrees. So this is what really the film is about.
You were born in Iran, and growing up there, I wonder, did you make art, and did you dream of being an artist?
Never. Actually, I have no idea why I became an artist. I actually was a terrible student at art school at Berkeley, and I didn't make art for about 11 years until I was finally able to go back. I was in the U.S. when the revolution took place, and I wasn't able to go back for 11 years, and then I returned for the first time. And then after a few trips going to Iran, I was really compelled to make art again because I had something to say, and I felt that I had the maturity and the visual language that I needed in order to create concepts and narratives that were meaningful for people to pay attention to. So my artistic practice really didn't begin until I was in my mid-30s.
Can we back up a moment? You said you were a terrible art student.
Yes.
Why do you say that? What was so terrible?
Well, you know, as many young art students, we have this romantic notion about becoming an artist. And I think there's a falsehood about how art is something that you're either born sort of talented or is something that you gain through an education. And throughout my life, I learned art is not that. Art is something that you gain through experience of living a life. It's something that you throw yourself into the world and you get beaten up and you see good and bad. And then you find questions, not answers. And therefore, I take my work very seriously and my job as an artist today. Where I was at school, I felt like I was just making more or less cliche artwork that didn't belong anywhere.
So you hadn't lived yet. And no. It must have been, I imagine, hard because you were pretty young. And here, as you say, you were away from your family then for 11 years.
Yes.
After the revolution, you couldn't go back, and an outsider in American culture so young. So what was that time like for you? And how does it figure into your work over these decades?
I think that, first of all, coming to America, you know, I had, like many Iranians, this image of Hollywood, this paradise, this place that was, especially Los Angeles, is where I landed for the first 2 years in high school. But this image of America pretty much quickly shattered. And for me, feeling quite alienated, and as a foreigner, as someone who desperately was nostalgic for her homeland and for my family, the next 12 years became an incredibly difficult and painful journey because the Iraq and Iran war broke out. We had the revolution, the diplomatic relationship between Iran and U.S. broke down, the walls came down between me and my country and me and my family, without over-dramatizing it, because many Iranians have suffered because of the aftermath of the revolution. But nevertheless, I found myself as a young person alone in this country and then had to survive. So I think much of the foundation of my narratives and my concept is that sense of melancholy and those kind of questioning, that kind of unresolved relationship to home, to homeland, to motherland, and my question to this country where I stand today, in my host country, all the subjects that are really close to my heart. And although I have to say, the recently I've lost all the nostalgia for Iran. I no longer want to go back. I've lost all of that. And I think in this exhibition you could see that now my lens is into this country, because I'm very worried about this country.
Well, I was going to ask you that next. You anticipated it. This is such a hostile time for immigrants here in the U.S. How or have you taken on U.S. politics directly in your work? I'm thinking President Trump's Muslim ban or the detention centers for undocumented workers. Or...
I mean, the best way I can explain that is how I put that material into my work. I, being like the protagonist of The Land of Dreams, I went to New Mexico. I chose that state to be the subject of my work, where it is the poorest state in America, as far as I know. It's a large Native American population. There's a huge Hispanic community, immigrants. There's extreme poverty. And I was able to, as an Iranian, go door to door and introduce myself and say, hey, I'm an Iranian and I want to make art and I want to collaborate with you. I wanted to know what is your experience living in this country today. And I was told, don't get near the natives. They don't like people coming to the reservation or be in a movie or be photographed. I photographed 200 people. I was able to interview every one of them individually and learn about their struggles and their lives. And I think it was the most eye-opener experience for me. I felt so bonded and they welcomed me. And it was then that I realized that, you know, this connection, how art and life mimic each other, that the subject of this film, Simin, goes around and photographs these people who are in a lot of disadvantage. And it was me who did that. And those photographs at the Broad shows they were my subjects. And every one of them were people who I spoke with and explained how I felt about sharing dreams, how I felt about being an Iranian that wasn't welcome back to her country, and how yet we are a foreigner inside of this country, how the natives feel like a foreigner in their own land. And therefore, it was an invigorating human experience. And for me, I tried to bring that into this work of art, and that somehow that gives you my point of view, where I stand in respect to this country. And I feel that more and more we need to see work made by immigrant artists.
Well, I just so appreciate you being here today, and I wish you the best with the exhibition.
Thank you so much.
That's artist Shireen Nashat. You can see her first West Coast exhibition at the Broad starting on October 19th, and it runs through February 2020. Coming up on our show, the new film Parasite is about a family who cons their way into the lives of a wealthy household with tragic comic results. Director Bong Joon-ho is here to tell us what he borrows from Hitchcock and why his films inevitably explore class conflict. And that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Two families in South Korea, the Kims, the Parks, one lives in a basement apartment, the other a mansion on a hill. The two families become intertwined when the wealthy Parks hires the son of the Kims to tutor their daughter. To him, their house is like a dream. And soon he orchestrates a series of lies to get his sister, his father, and his mother all jobs at the house. It's the plot of the new movie Parasite, the winner of this year's Palme d'Or in Cannes. It opened last weekend, breaking box office records, and is now the biggest limited opening of the year. Bong Joon-ho directed the film, and I spoke with him earlier this week. And just a quick note, at some points during our interview, he speaks through his translator, Sharon Choi. It's so good to have you across the table from me.
I'm so happy to be here.
You know, your film starts with this simple story.
Yeah.
A boy from a poor family goes to work as a tutor of a wealthy student. But then all of a sudden there are twists and turns, and suddenly you realize as a viewer you just have no idea where it's going. What gave you the original idea?
When I was in university, I also experienced tutoring job, also in very rich house.
So you tutored a kid in one of these incredibly sleek modern homes?
It was quite common in our generation to tutoring some boys or girls, the student, and 남의 집에 침투하는 느낌.
So I was just there to make money, but I got the sense that I was infiltrating someone else's home.
그리고 이제 제 친구들 막
And I imagined what it would be like to introduce my friends as tutors for other subjects for my student.
Oh, so you felt like kind of a spy, and you imagined if you just brought your friends over, like one at a time?
I'm not that evil
mastermind.
College student. I'm not that evil at the time, but anyway, it makes me, 그런 생각하는 것 자체가 이제 좀.
So I was just fascinated by the thought of it, but I couldn't put it into practice because I was fired only after 2 months.
Why? Why were you fired?
아니, 맨날 수업 안 하고.
So instead of teaching the boy, we shared many conversations about life. They were great.
Oh, so you talked too much and didn't teach enough.
Never teach, but talk.
In the film, the mother wants to watch the boy tutoring. Is that what happened with you? Is that how they knew you were talking too much?
It is quite fictional, but 요즘은 그렇게 많이 한다.
I heard that it's common with parents these days to just watch the class full time.
Maybe it's very suffocating, I think.
Right, and nanny cam, surveillance cameras, things like that. What I really appreciated about the film, how it touches on these ideas of class differences, and there are all these offhand and subtle moments that show the distance between these two families. And the one I'm thinking of is when Mrs. Park, the mom in the wealthy family, is interviewing Ki-woo, the son, for the tutor position, and he gives her this diploma that his sister has gone to so much trouble to forge because he hasn't graduated from college, and she tosses the diploma aside and she just says, I don't care about documents, let's talk. And I'm thinking, of course, when you're rich, you don't care about the papers. They mean nothing to you because you're rich. Every door opens. But if you're poor, your papers are everything.
It's just for her, it's kind of better to have trust.
So her, it's really about trust. He was recommended by someone that she likes.
Right, right. If you're in a certain class, then people recommend, and it is all about.
It's very simple. Very simple logic, but it's quite dangerous.
Well, yes, it opens you to grifters, which is what happens in this film. Did you have to research any techniques that con men and women use in order to do this kind of thing?
Actually, the protagonist, the family in this movie, they are not the criminals or gangsters. They are very normal people, but their situation is very bad. So very naturally, they become those kind of con artists, but they are actually not so professional as a con artist.
But good.
But they are doing quite well.
Yes. So,
in some aspect, they...
So this is a little dangerous to say, but when you see them, in that process, they're almost adorable.
That's really true. And that gets to the other thing that is walking such a admirable line in this film, which is that no one is purely bad and no one is purely good.
Yeah, every character is in gray zone in this movie.
Yes.
There is no villain, no evil, no demon in this movie.
That's right. And it gives you so much to think about as you're watching. I was thinking that your other film, Snowpiercer, and this film, they both deal with economic inequality. Mm. In Snowpiercer, mm. you had this train that in the front, it's for the beautiful and the rich. And in the back, the train is this just yeah. horrible cesspool place for mm. the underclass. So is this class something that you struggle with, you think about a lot in your own life, and mm. you make movies about it, or do you find that it inspires your best ideas?
So I wouldn't call it an obsession, but I think it is just one of the major issues of our current times. And as a creator, very naturally, I just talk about the main issues that surround us.
Quite recently, I met Jordan Peele mm-hmm. in some event, and yeah, very brief encounter. And yeah, he also made great film, Us. It's just something about the class.
And get
and,
out.
Yeah, social mm. status. And so, and also the Koreeda Hirokawa's Japanese master, he also made the Shoplifters. So,
it's very natural for creators to deal with this theme.
I'm glad you brought up the Shoplifters because mm-hmm. another fantastic film. And your
beautiful
film at the
beginning,
beautiful,
yeah, beautiful,
moving.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
And your film in the beginning reminds me very much of it. Mm-hmm. It's this family. Very close and living mm-hmm. in very close quarters mm-hmm. by necessity because of mm-hmm. class. They're very poor, but also they're very intimate, and that's what you that's what you see almost all throughout your film. That the poor family, you always see all four of them. It's a mother, father, a daughter, and a son. All four of them are in the shot, very tight together. They move as a group, and they're very close, and there's this great relationships between them. And whereas the wealthy family, you hardly ever see, you never see all four of them together. You hardly ever see any intimacy between them.
They are always very separated in different position of that huge big house, but poor family, they have a very small space, so it's impossible they can keep the distance. But not only because that, but also because
they're very affectionate. They just love to eat together as well.
Yes,
it's a very Asian portrait of a family. You see that in Shoplifters too.
That's true. So as a filmmaker, how consciously were you doing that? Because I know you storyboard.
Yeah.
You wrote this movie, you directed it, and you storyboarded it. And I think you drew the storyboards.
Actually, I drew my whole storyboard. And recently, the one Korean company published it as a book.
Oh, it's so, available as a book.
Yeah.
So you're a cartoonist.
I'm very happy. I have illusion. Now I became a graphic novel artist, kind of illusion.
Was that
very
your dream growing up?
Yes, I did want to be a comic book artist at times.
Oh, wonderful. Who is
this
that?
Is radio, not
you're,
TV.
You're,
during talking,
You're drawing as we're talking.
Anyway.
Well, so it sounds like you were an obsessive, or you are an obsessive storyboarder, because the house in this film ends up having so much personality. It's like another member of the cast. And I know somewhere you said you love Hitchcock movies.
Yeah.
And that you went back and watched Psycho a couple of times while working on this film. Why? What were you looking to borrow from Psycho? Because when I think of Psycho, I think of that amazing staircase and the shot of Martin Balsam falling back.
Yeah, on the
backwards stair. Down those stairs.
Yeah. Actually, this movie, Parasite, is also some kind of stair movie, I think. Like Joseph Loge is The Servant, or quite many Hitchcock movies. Not only Psycho, but also Notorious.
Vertigo,
yeah. So many stairs in Hitchcock movies. I'm very strongly inspired by Hitchcock film. Hitchcock has a great sense of humor, I think. And
he also shows powerful contrast between light and darkness.
Yeah.
Oh, and if I think of your film, again, not giving anything away, what I notice is there's a lot of movement between this house on a hill and the very kind of low bottom alley where the poorer family lives and in the basement. And there's a lot of movement of the characters from up to down and light to darkness.
Very vertical movement.
Yes, and was that something,
that's
kind of something you were playing with very consciously.
Yeah, that's the cinema, I think, the contrast between light and darkness, and that's the Hitchcock, I think.
I know you wrote a script on the plane back to Korea after you won your award. can you tell us anything about that? Or is that, do you write often in planes?
Yeah, South Korea, from Cannes to South Korea, it takes
it's
almost
long.
16 hours to Charles de Gaulle and transfer, and Charles de Gaulle to Korea, it takes almost 11, 12 hours.
Was it an idea that had been dancing around in your head already, or did something strike you coming back from this amazing experience of
sweeping
the festival?
I'm a very obsessional person, so always 24 hours in my mind something is going on, but 실제 키보드를 두들기는
so 시간은 물론 have a certain segment of my brain that's constantly ruminating on these ideas, but the actual script writing process for me, it's pretty limited. Or the time that I spend writing on writing scripts is pretty limited.
So while we're sitting here talking, in the back of your head, you're thinking about something.
That the KCRW, yeah.
Our logo.
He was actually creating a very strange sentence with that KCRW logo.
in English?
Yeah.
Kicking
Coca-Cola and R, yeah. Yeah, I keep thinking about it, kind of. What's the KCRW? And, yeah.
Have you seen anything here in L.A. that has inspired an idea for you?
In L.A.?
Yeah, on this trip.
In L.A., the smell. Yesterday when I drive in L.A., there was some smell. People said it's from the fire in the mountain. Yeah, I'm very sensitive to the smells, and also wow. LA는 원래 이제 West Coast의 그런 좋은 공기.
So LA is known to have relatively good air, and the West Coast, of course, there are the highways that get in the way of that. But yeah, I sense this smoky smell that was coming from the fires.
I'm glad I asked you that because smell is such a big part of the film. There's
yeah,
a
exactly.
running,
yeah, yeah.
a kind of a thread that goes through mm-hmm. it that poor people smell a certain way. There are many references to that.
Yeah. Actually, everyday life, we always smell. 알잖아요, 사실 다 냄새 맡는 건데.
So we all know about smell. We all smell it. It's just that we don't talk about it out in the open because it might seem rude. And I think this story really lays it out in the open. And I think there's an uncomfortable sense of fun that comes from that.
Yes, and I didn't say it quite right. It's really that to these wealthy people, they think that poor people have a certain smell. They call it a subway smell.
Yeah,
or it's what the subway smells like.
되게 잔인한 대사들이 좀 있죠.
So yeah, that line is very brutal, and I think that's the line that separates the characters within this film. You know, that line that Mr. Park constantly talks about, you know, not wanting anyone to cross that line that he draws.
어떻게 보면 그게 비극의 씨앗인 것 같아요.
So this film is both a comedy and a tragedy, and I think smell is basically the seed of the tragedy that unfolds in this film.
Oh, so interesting. And you, do you think you have a heightened sense of smell, or is it just something you're always aware of?
후각이 좋아요. 네. 그리고 또 공포감이 있어요. 지금 내 몸에서.
I have a heightened sense of smell, and I also always carry this fear of what I smell.
I was just going to say I'm getting very paranoid about what you're smelling over there. Thank you so much. It's just really great to meet you, and thank you for taking the time to come on our show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Bong Joon-ho is director of the movie Parasite. It's in theaters now. And special thanks to you, Sharon Choi. Thank you very much for translating.
Thank you.
Michelle Aloy is here with Feedback. Michelle, Bong Joon-ho is a lovely person.
Oh, I can't wait to go see that movie.
Oh, you will.
Looks
love it.
So great.
Yeah, and it really is, as our film critics, I think, said earlier in the week, it encompasses everything. It's tragic. There's comedy. It's a fable. It's a class conflict.
I was a little hesitant. Like, when I first saw the trailer, I thought it was kind of sort of in the horror genre, and I
know. It does give that impression.
I'm such a baby when it comes to all of that. Like, truly, I mean, Stranger Things is, like, my limit.
How about violence, though?
That doesn't faze me. I mean, anything where anything is popping up is just not going to do it for me. I'm that person in the theater who will scream.
Okay, I don't think you're in trouble. It's not.
Okay.
There's no harm.
I have been assured that it was a, like you said, a blend of genres. So that I'm going to go see it. But if we had a crazy day in the newsroom today.
Oh, we absolutely did. We had an earthquake drill right along with everyone else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then a news break drill.
Today? Right.
That was not a drill.
Well, the earthquake drill happened as White House Acting Press Secretary Mick Mulvaney started his press conference.
Right.
So I was under my desk typing.
Oh, whoa.
That's right, because I didn't leave. That was while everyone else was outside.
You're just hanging out under your desk.
More people get hurt going outside buildings during earthquakes.
That's what I thought, too. Please advise earthquakes officials. Lisi Jones, tell us what to do.
That's going to do it for us for today. Thank you very much for this, and thank you for listening. I'm Barbara Bogave. I'll see you tomorrow.